If there were a stock market for pop culture obsessions with monsters, it might go something like this. Vampires have been solid earners for years now. Zombies were a hot startup in 2010. Werewolves are on the rise, and witches threaten to be the next big thing. Our TV critic David Bean Cooley uses the new DVD release and imminent return of HBO's True Blood to examine our obsessions with things that go bump in the night.
HBO Video has just released Season 3 of True Blood, 12 episodes bringing us up to speed on Sookie Stackhouse, the psychic southern waitress, on Bill Compton and Eric Northman, the two vampires in love with her, and on all the other far-from-normal residents of and around this particular bayou town. And in a few weeks, on June 26th, HBO launches Season 4 of True Blood, which doubles down on its paranormal plot lines. When we left off, Sookie, played by Anna Paquin, had felt used and betrayed by both her vampire lovers and discovered that her own psychic gifts, as well as some more recent ones, were due to a formerly unknown lineage. She's part human and, as it turns out, part fairy. Her loyal vampire boyfriend, Bill Compton, doesn't love her any less. But another vampire, Russell, the sinister vampire king of Mississippi, warns Sookie there might be a reason for that. Russell explains this as Sookie has him chained and captured, and just after he's almost burned to death from exposure to the sun. Dennis O'Hare, as Russell the King, gives one of my favorite performances in True Blood. He seems to purr and snarl all at once. And in this scene, he's saying all this to Anna Paquin's Sookie while looking like a charred hot dog that was left out on the grill way too long.
Miss Stackhouse, I'd like to propose a deal.
Oh. This ought to be good.
I will give you my word that I will not harm you or anyone you love.
Stepping around the fact that your word's worth about as much as tits on a turtle? What else?
$1 million.
Five.
Two.
Seven.
Okay, five.
What else?
I will kill Eric Northman. And Bill Compton. Both. Or neither. Or just one of your choosing.
Both. And your house in Mississippi. I like that house.
Done.
What do I have to do in return?
Release me!
No.
It may not be me, but someday some vampire's gonna rip you open to get at the essence inside of you. There's no way around that.
Shut up.
You don't know what it is to drink your blood. It is paradise, Arcadia, Nirvana. Who even knows what your blood is capable of? I am surprised that your Mr. Compton has showed such restraint. He is either a true gentleman or very, very smart.
Smart why?
By showing such a degree of control, he's able to make the experience last that much longer. That's the basic tantra. But others won't be able to stop themselves. They'll drain you dry, which is a shame, really.
It makes perfect sense that True Blood is returning on HBO and being released on DVD during the summer. Based on the novels by Charlaine Harris and adapted for TV by Six Feet Under creator Alan Ball, True Blood is the TV equivalent of the perfect summer beach book. It's funny, it's sexy, it's imaginative, it's outrageous. And, like Sookie's human fairy blood, it's addictive. It also passes my basic test for any great ensemble TV series. Its characters are so well written and so well acted that I can spend time with any of them without missing the others. In Season 3 on the DVD set, True Blood introduces plenty of new characters in addition to O'Hare's Vampire King. There are fairies, shapeshifters, werewolves, and in Season 4 we'll get heavily into the world of witches. It's a smart move, because even though vampires are among the hottest things in pop culture right now, even monsters are vulnerable to the fickleness of public taste. Both True Blood and the Twilight movie series began in 2008, and both have invested heavily in werewolves as well as vampires. But in this new decade of television, vampires are in danger of being temporarily overrun. Last year on AMC, a zombie series based on a graphic novel, The Walking Dead, came out of nowhere and set viewership records for that network, almost three times the audience for AMC's Mad Men. MTV has a new series based on an old Michael J. Fox movie, Teen Wolf. And this fall, the CW network, which already has injected werewolves into its series The Vampire Diaries, hedges its bets by presenting Secret Circle about a coven of young witches. My bet, though, is that vampires, more than werewolves, zombies, or witches, will prove to be the most durable media monsters of all. It's been almost 90 years since the first memorable movie vampire, Nosferatu, hit the big screen, and exactly 80 years since Bela Lugosi played Dracula. Those guys were monsters, though. Creepy bloodsuckers, not the stuff of swoony romance novels. All that changed in the 1950s when Christopher Lee embodied a more seductive brand of bloodsucker in a series of Hammer Studios horror films. And it was codified in the 1960s on television when a daytime soap opera called Dark Shadows presented the central vampire for the first time as a misunderstood, haunted victim. That's the model that's been followed for the most part ever since, from Frank Langella's matinee idol Dracula to all the present-day vampires on Twilight, True Blood, and elsewhere. So zombies may be popular now, and werewolves and witches may be on the rise, but for a safe long-term investment in pop culture's fascination with the paranormal, I say take your money and let it ride on vampires. They're undead in more ways than one. Every generation, they always seem to earn a brand new life.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferby is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
When you came in, the air went out. And every shadow filled up with doubt. I don't know who you think you are, but before the night is through, I wanna do bad things with you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel.
I started singing,
that's Don McLean's song American Pie, and it figures prominently in our next story. A Michigan city is trying to put a positive spin on a negative story published by Newsweek earlier this year. As Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith reports, the people of Grand Rapids have put together a remarkable music video set to American Pie, and it's getting rave reviews.
It was late January when Newsweek published a seemingly innocuous article listing America's top 10 dying cities. The list was based on total population loss and the loss of those residents younger than 18. It's really no surprise that three of those cities were in Michigan, which was hammered hard by the recession. Detroit, Flint, and Grand Rapids all made the list. So what can you do to refute that your city isn't really dying? Here's what these guys in Grand Rapids did.
If you're a featured extra or a featured character, stay where you are. Otherwise, we need extras in Rosa Parks Circle. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Joe Pesch.
I'm Paul Lungeski. We're definitely trying to get used to how fast we have to go to keep up with the camera today.
Joe and Paul are two of the nearly 5,000 people who took part in the Grand Rapids Lipped Up video. Just imagine a whole lot of people singing karaoke to the same song at the same time. The hard part is shooting a video of them lip-syncing the song in a continuous shot. One take, no edits. It's kind of the holy grail of videos, and it's not easy.
I'm Nick Lavelle. We're all part of the crew, and it's our job to manage and organize our separate event areas. We have a section with the fire department, a section with pillow fighters, a section with zombie fighters. All of these different events need to be organized across Grand Rapids.
There's also a section of the Lipped Up with kayakers, Nerf gun shooters, marching bands, explosions, even a helicopter takeoff.
My name is George Hartwell. I'm the mayor of Grand Rapids, the greatest city in the galaxy. And my role in Lip Dub is to ride in the back of this car.
We sing.
And there we were all in one place. A generation lost in space with no time left to start again.
Okay,
fortunately, this is a Lip Dub, and
and
Don McLean will be singing it instead of us.
Hartwell has been railing on Newsweek ever since it published the Dying Cities list. Here he is in his State of the City speech.
Just last July, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce awarded Grand Rapids its Siemens Award for the most sustainable mid-sized city in America. Now, put that in your pipe, Newsweek, and smoke it.
Grand Rapids' population did decline over the past 10 years by about 2%. But the Lip Dub Video's director, Rob Bliss, says that certainly doesn't mean Grand Rapids is dying, though in making his point, he insults another Michigan city.
Its culture is growing so rapidly that I think that's what just surprised people. I think Flint was like 9 or something like that. So to think that we're just like a step away from Flint, I think was ridiculous.
Bliss and his buddy Scott Erickson had to raise close to $40,000 to pull off the Lip Dub video. When it was released late last week, fans plastered the Lip Dub all over Newsweek's Facebook page. Newsweek quickly issued a statement on their page asking people to spread the word that the magazine loves Grand Rapids. Their editorial staff doesn't agree with the Dying Cities list, that they didn't even create it, only published it through a content-sharing deal with another website. Considering the video has over 1 million views, Erickson says they don't even care Newsweek hasn't said the words, "We're sorry." Don McLean is the original singer-songwriter of American Pie. The rock folk song topped the charts for a month in 1971. Now, 40 years later, film critic Roger Ebert is calling the Grand Rapids music video the best ever made. For NPR News, I'm Lindsay Smith in Grand Rapids.
And you can see the Grand Rapids Lip Dub video at npr.org. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the Ford Pinto. And this week, fans of the much-maligned economy car are celebrating with a drive from Colorado to Pennsylvania. NPR's Jeff Brady met up with the husband and wife who are leading the trip.
My name is Louise Baggy. I live in Milford, Pennsylvania. This is my 1976 Pinto with a V6 and air conditioning, which is a rare breed.
Baggy's husband, Norman, says the upholstery inside this hatchback is a sight to behold.
The seats had the upgraded blue and orange plaid, which you've seen, just fabulous to look at. You know, it's almost like the Brady Bunch threw up in that car. It's wonderful.
And right in the middle between the seats there, you have a fire extinguisher.
Yeah. Yes, we do. That actually is at my request, because just in case.
It's impossible to talk about the Pinto without mentioning the one thing probably everyone knows about the car.
Yeah, you hit them in the butt and they blow up. Well, you know, there was a lot of hype about that.
Norman Baggy can be defensive about the Pinto. He says the problem was exaggerated, and now there's a simple retrofit that fixes the fuel system issue. Baggy is totally into the retrofits. Just listen to his 1977 powder blue Pinto coupe.
It doesn't sound like any Pinto I've ever heard before.
No, they never came with a V8, but a lot of people did that to them.
Baggy says he started out a Mustang fan, but now he's all about the Pinto.
This car makes other people happy, which is kind of unusual. They beep at you, they wave, they pull out their phone, they try to take pictures. They'll follow you to the gas station and get out and talk about the Pinto they had or their sister had or the first car they had in college. You know, they lost their virginity in a car like this. You know, you would be surprised the stories that you hear.
The Baggies are leading their caravan of Pinto drivers from Denver to an auto show in Carlisle, Pennsylvania this week.
How far are you going to be driving then?
I think we're driving about 1,600 miles.
Wow. I don't want to be indelicate or offend you, but do you have any concern about getting there?
No, in my Pinto, never. Not in a million years. I'm more worried about the tornadoes that are in the Midwest than I am about my Pinto.
The Pinto Stampede is scheduled to arrive in Pennsylvania on Thursday. Organizers are using the drive to raise money for the Wounded Warrior Project. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
Made for the American road. Pinto. Made for the American road.
This is NPR.
The United States of America is the most successful nation the world has ever known.
Summer movie season is here, and while what you're hearing may sound like a trailer for a summer blockbuster,
humans cannot reach their potential, cannot realize their dreams unless they're free.
It's actually an ad from presidential candidate Tim Pawlenty.
We have seen difficulties before.
Sounds exciting, right? Here's another one.
I think we have to tell the American people the truth and lead with integrity. And ask the American people to rise to the occasion.
That's an ad from Mitt Romney, who announced his own presidential bid this past week. These ads use sweeping music, cinematic editing, and look more like Hollywood movie trailers than commercials about politicians. That's our cover story today, how Hollywood is reshaping campaign politics, why voters might buy in, and why one conservative movie producer is betting $1 million that they will. I'm Rachel Martin, in for Guy Raz. This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News.
They're very good ads.
Darrell West is author of Air Wars, Television Advertising in Election Campaigns.
They demonstrate kind of a new emerging trend in campaign advertising because we're seeing kind of a blurring of the line between politics and entertainment.
These ads, released online and some 2 minutes long, are coming mainly from Republicans right now. But West says their inspiration probably lies in Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. Back then, Obama aired a half-an-hour television special in primetime that was pretty cinematic in its own right.
The viewer is seeing wheat fields in the background. You see Americans engaging in daily activities. And then in the video itself, once you get into it,
each passing month,
Barack Obama uses very powerful visuals, images that people could relate to, and then using ordinary Americans to tell the story about the problems that they were having.
Mark Dowell and his wife Melinda have worked at the local plant for most of their adult lives. Juliana Sanchez is a widow with two children and a mortgage.
So that was 2008. Today's presidential candidates aren't just using narrative and music to tug on your heartstrings. They're trying to rip them apart.
It takes an extraordinary effort. It takes extraordinary commitment.
Some of these ads actually do take on the features of a mini movie.
The Valley Forge wasn't easy.
Campaigns today really require a very strong storyline because there's just so much information out there in society. You need a strong narrative to break through all that information clutter.
And the rewards of breaking through that clutter are huge. In 2008, West says 80% of voters said TV was the most likely way they'd learn about a political candidate. 71% said political ads help me understand what a candidate stands for.
When you look at a campaign budget, about half of the money still goes for television ads because that's still, even in the internet era, where people get much of their information about the campaign.
And what about style? Is there any evidence that these more epic, cinematic ads work better than traditional political ads? Is the audience saying, yeah, I'd see that movie?
People do believe that these epic ads are influential. Voters like to see those types of presentations. They often find those presentations memorable. And that style of communication can be very effective for politicians.
Darrell West, he's the author of Air Wars, Television Advertising in Election Campaigns. For a deeper look at the cinematic techniques at work in ads like Tim Pawlenty's, we went to NPR's film critic, Bob Mandello.
If you watch this ad, it is a whole bunch of little tiny bits. Lots of quick edits between things like a Martin Luther King speech and jets flying over. I'm not sure what all that has to do with Mr. Pawlenty, but it places him there. And the other thing is that he doesn't speak to the camera in this. He's giving speeches, but you never see him just sort of looking at the camera the way that you do in most political ads. It's designed to place him in the context of Americana and make him look very forceful by making him sound forceful. It puts all that music behind him.
Let's talk about that music. I mean, first, before we talk, let's take a listen.
If prosperity were easy, everybody around the world would be prosperous. If freedom were easy, everybody around the world would be free. If security were easy, everybody around the world would be secure. They are not.
That's high drama, man. Okay, now let's hear the speech from the ad, but as Pawlenty originally delivered it at the National Press Club this year.
If prosperity were easy, everybody around the world would be prosperous. If freedom were easy, everybody around the world would be free. If security were easy, everybody around the world would be secure. They are not.
So a little different.
Yeah, no, he's actually delivering the speech pretty forcefully. But, you know, when you have that music behind you, I mean, I want brasses behind me when I'm talking.
Yeah, it makes you sound very important.
Exactly. There's also a history of using this to power speeches in movies. And I have a favorite example of that. If you go back to the Henry V that Laurence Olivier made, he made it at the height of World War II, and he was trying to inspire the British public, and he did that with the music of his own voice.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so base.
That's 1944. Now, Kenneth Branagh came along and wanted to do Henry V in 1989. That's a different era. That's after Vietnam. War doesn't sound as appealing to a contemporary audience, so he needed to punch it up a little. And listen what he did.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here.
Wow.
It's soaring, isn't
it?
Oh,
it is soaring.
And you do. You get all goosebumply.
And there's an optimism, strangely enough, about this speech of war.
Yeah. That music is just soaring, and it really pumps it.
But really what this is about is telling stories. Mm. And that's what filmmakers are doing. That's what they do with this music. They're trying to lead us to an emotional place. I guess it would make sense that in politics, they're trying to do the same thing. They're creating leading men and women characters.
You know, in film, you want to use everything that's at your disposal. You use the sound and you use the visuals, and these days you use the 3D to try and make it as full an experience as possible. I assume that in politics, they are trying to do exactly the same thing.
NPR's Bob Mondello. Thanks.
Thank you.
Another candidate, potential candidate that is, with a cinematic call to action, is Sarah Palin. Filmmaker Steve Bannon spent $1 million on a documentary film about Palin. It's called The Undefeated, and it will screen across the country this month. Bannon says he made the film without any editorial input from the Palin camp, and he reaches deep for theatrical inspiration.
I needed to get to the people in Alaska. They would be kind of the Greek chorus. And you would actually be in the middle of the whirlwind, which was Governor Palin's time in Alaska. I would bring in sound ups. You bring in news footage. You bring in interviews. You bring in speeches. You bring in all this great footage they had out there in Alaska television. As I started to get into the film and actually physically make it, I realized I didn't want a narrator and I needed a linking device. Since I had studied particularly the first half of Going Rogue.
Sarah Palin's book.
Yeah, we went to HarperCollins and got the audio rights. So you hear her voice in there and it kind of links the scenes together.
So some might see a precedent for this work looking at Barack Obama's half-an-hour television special that aired during the 2008 presidential campaign. Do you see a connection there? How is your film different?
I think it's very different. Look, I think film is, you know, plenty put out a two-minute video to start as. I think people are putting out videos and understanding that media is much more sophisticated. I think that I hearken back really to Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. I think feature film, and I think particularly feature nonfiction or documentary, can have a major role in explaining ideas and describing people's lives and their struggles. If a screenwriter had pitched you some of this, you know, her struggles with big oil and her struggles with the Republican establishment, it would be something like out of a screenplay. So these things lend themselves to dramatic interpretation, and I think you're going to see a lot more of it in the future.
And you talk about using these characters from Alaska as a sort of Greek chorus with Sarah Palin as the heroine. Is there a risk of building her up as this character, as this leading lady, to the point where she can't possibly live up to the characterization of her?
Well, no, there's a lot of, by the way, it's not all successes. There's failures throughout this film. That's why I think it's inspirational. I think I have not heard one person that's seen this that's been a politically liberal say that I had to fix in to kind of, you know, make this like she's some sort of superwoman. It's not that at all.
So is Sarah Palin running for president?
You know, I have no idea. The good news is the other night Greta Van Susteren asked her what she thought when she saw the film. And her quote was, it blew her away. But she mispronounced my name. So it's, I don't really have any involvement.
Would you like her to run for president? Did you make this movie to convince her to run for president?
I certainly didn't make this movie to convince her, but I do think it's very important for particularly the Republicans and the conservatives to have a campaign like 1976 where you had President Reagan as an outsider.
But, you know, we should point out that the Republicans did lose in 1976.
They lost in 1976, that's correct, but you would not have had the Reagan Revolution. That's a great point. You had to have that to have the Reagan Revolution. I mean, look, this title of The Undefeated, deleted because some of the left-wing bloggers have already said, well, doesn't the guy know she lost Lieutenant Governor last
night?
There
is that, yeah.
Well, but you have to see the film. It's about some of the values she stands for, of the American working class, of the American middle class, these things of self-reliance and self-determination. That's really the undefeated. And I made a bet at the beginning of this that American people are not just a fair people, they're an open-minded people. And I think if they see this film, I believe they'll see Governor Palin. They may not agree with her politically, but they will see her in a very different light.
So you liken yourself more to Michael Moore as a filmmaker, but Michael Moore is a very political, polarizing figure, someone who doesn't shy away from the fact that he's got an agenda, a political agenda. Do you think of yourself as a conservative counterpoint to that?
No, I would never. I think Michael Moore, look, is a master of the craft. I'm learning the craft. I don't agree with Michael Moore's politics, but I love watching his films because I think he's a master of what he does. Look, I think it takes the subject. We've had some Shakespearean characters in our politics. Here, I think we're, you know, very blessed in the degree that we have someone like Governor Palin, who comes from America's last frontier, and you also have President Obama, who comes from a very different perspective, but is also a very fascinating story.
Steve Bannon joined us from Arlington, Virginia. Thanks very much, Steve.
Thanks, Rachel. Appreciate having me on.